It was just this kind of magical feeling of something that you can't put into words. And that's probably one of the reasons why I got into music in the first place, was trying to create something that can give you this immense feeling inside you that I've never felt with any other art form, actually. And music still to this day does that for me more than anything else.
I'm Iarla Ollinard, and this is Vocal Chords, an exploration of the voice in music. And my guest in this episode is Linda Buckley, a composer of mesmerizing sonic work, who uses the voice, and often her own voice, with powerful impact in her work. Her work is atmospheric, drawn to the sounds of the sea and nature, and inspired by the soundscape of her childhood growing up on a farm at the old head of Kinsale. She's an explorer and collector of sounds, often using electronic tools to create dreamlike textures. But she's also a singer, and from a family of singers, and she instinctively uses her voice both to compose and create.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good.
One of the things I always found really interesting about you, Linda, was that people don't assume that a composer has a specific relationship with the voice, but you're quite the exception. You do have. And maybe it's the fact that you're one of nine.
That is true. I sing all the time when I'm composing. And I feel like the most natural thing to do, because I feel like it's the purest, closest expression to your own inner life and your soul in a way. So that's a massive part of when I'm composing. And it was a huge part of growing up as well. Music was always in the house and singing, whether it be traditional Irish music or the Cocteau Twins. And my sister and I would sit down and play their records and take out a notebook and try to write down what she was singing. But of course, it was strings of random syllables. And we would learn them off and sing along. So that was interesting for me to think that you can go beyond your own spoken language. And this had a massive impact on me as a young child, and that has kind of carried through my whole life.
Were you listening to music through your older siblings? You're the youngest of nine.
I was really lucky that I had older sisters especially who had really good taste in music. And a lot of like ambient, electronic, post-punk, indie. So that was a huge part of my kind of formative years as well.
They had their own playlists. What were they exactly? Paint a picture for me. Were there cassettes? Were there?
One of the first things would have been records. And we had this old record player. And it would be things like Kate Bush. That was one of my first loves. And it was so good of my parents in a way. It was my Christmas Santa Claus present would be another Kate Bush record every year. So this is at, you know, a very young age. So that was hugely important for me. And her influence on me is still kind of far reaching, I think, into my life now.
Do you see yourself as a singer?
That's an interesting question, and I don't really as such, but I think it's also something when you grow up in a big family, certain people are assigned certain roles, and my sister Annette, I always would have thought of is the singer. Singing eyes and fingers drew me loving into your eyes, and you sang, sail to me, sail to me, let me unfold you.
I've seen you on stage singing, and I never got the impression it's something you kind of felt you had to do. It's more you want to do it, and it's you're doing it.
Even when I sing in live performance, I go into myself internally, and I often close my eyes, and I'm under a spell. I don't feel like I'm doing anything theatrical or I'm presenting something that is very public. I feel like I am sharing a private part of myself in a way. So there's something very vulnerable about it. But that's, I suppose, the beauty of it, in that it's the closest to your own spirit that you're sharing with the world.
Well, I've met you with a number of your sisters a number of times. I'm one of 12, you know, so I know the geography. Is singing with family something you still do and like to do?
Well, there's a reason they call it blood voices. There's something that happens, which is so incredible that you can never explain, that happens especially if I'm singing with my sister Irene. We never have to look at each other when we're singing. Our phrasing absolutely lines up. Sometimes I'm not even sure whose voice it is. Is it me? Is it her? It merges so absolutely in a unified sense that I've never had that with any other singers.
That's fascinating, the family thing. And as a young girl, you're growing up on a farm, there's a sonic world there. And then you're growing up in a big family, one assumes there's a sonic world there, whether it's the culture of song or music playing in the house, but also what people talk about and what they listen to on the radio. And then of course there's the parental influence. Can sail the old head, cliffs, the ocean. How much did that feed your musical imagination?
I think it had a huge impact on me, and I think at the time you're not necessarily aware of these external forces coming into play, and this really came to the fore for me years later, looking back on hindsight and thinking, well, why am I making the kind of music that I'm making, and what is emerging from my past experience? And I think a lot of it is to do with those early years and the sounds of sea and the peaks and troughs of that.
Is there anything in particular that percolated into your imagination from that experience, do you think? Or is it a general hum, if you like?
Well, hum is a good word to use, because one of the major things would have been the sounds of milking machines. So that was a massive thing for me in terms of being immersed in almost like a surround sound situation and being in the middle of these drones and kind of singing over them. I always drawn to that in other music, that feeling of being in the middle of this lush wall of sound, which is not something you associate maybe with, you know, some people, when they think of me coming from a rural place, they think of these, you know, beautiful natural landscape sounds. And, you know, this is something that's more sort of industrial. So it's all of those things together, I think. And foghorns as well, which is one of my earliest memories.
And is it safe to say then that that sort of notion that music can find itself living inside a sort of a drone, does that specifically happen then in some music you created later?
Absolutely. And I think sometimes for me when I'm composing, it's almost like when you wake up and you've had a dream and you're trying to remember parts of the dream. Sometimes composing is like that for me, where you're trying to capture this feeling or this atmosphere or this emotion and being in it. So that's why a lot of the music that I love, it's about being inside something for a long period of time. And I'm drawn to things then like, you know, Indian classical music or plain chant, and just being kind of sitting in this world of sound for a long period of time.
You went on to study in UCC with such folks as Mel Mercier, and what was it like?
I have such a distinct memory of going to the UCC Music Open Day, and this would be in 1995, I think. So I was still in secondary school, and I first experienced the Javanese Gamelan Orchestra, and I was absolutely mesmerized. And I felt, okay, this is where I need to be. And I have such a strong memory of those first weeks of being in college and feeling this is absolutely right, this is where I should be. You know, there was some talk of me staying and doing a transition year. They were just trying to introduce it at that time in secondary school, and they were asking me about it, and I said, absolutely no. I really want to continue on. I know what I want to do. And I was quite young. I was 17 through my whole first year of college, but I just loved it so much, and I just thought, this is where I need to be.
You did classes in composition there as well, and also you did some traditional singing. So there was a strong Irish folk dimension. Was that important, do you think, to you?
Oh, it was very important. I studied channels with Eilish Ní Hualáin. And I remember in any one given day, I might have a Shannos lesson, and then I might have a medieval class, and then I would be, you know, doing African drumming, and then I would be doing like Indian vocal percussion, and just moving very fluidly between these worlds and loving all of it.
I'm jealous listening to it, because I that didn't happen to me. Were there any songs in particular you remember from Eilish?
One of my favourites at that time from her was Shula Roon.
The Elizabeth Cronin Macronic jewel. What struck you about that song?
So haunting and heartbreaking. And another one that really struck me was Donal Óg, and just that sense of loss that you feel when you're singing that. And that last line, which is so heartbreaking, God himself, if I'm not mistaken, you've taken everything from me, the sun, moon and stars and God. And the sense of disappointment of the empty promises of lost love. And that has stayed with me, that kind of that feeling of the melancholy of that over the years.
When you sing Shannos yourself, what happens to you? Do you like doing that?
I always kind of get transported off into another place. And I don't know how to explain it in a way. I remember actually even singing the Ar na hÉir and that resonance of church acoustic and the sound kind of seeping through you and that feeling of something beyond yourself. And it's really hard to put into words, but I experienced that more with the voice than with anything else. And I've experienced it most in choirs as well. And that's one of the things I remember most about my early days at UCC. I sang in a piece, Szymanowski's Stabat Mater, and it was just so beautiful, and that feeling of being in the middle of all this sound. And I still to this day love singing in choirs for that reason, because you are just kind of saturated by this beautiful sound around you.
A lot of people would say electronic, not transcendent, electronic, robotic, machine. But in your framework for composition, the electronic is totally central, really, isn't it?
It is, and I sometimes get asked this by people thinking that, you know, electronic music conjures up something that's cold and clinical and not emotional and not harmonic and not beautiful. But I would say absolutely the opposite, that it allows me to enter into that space privately in a way, because I can build all of this myself. And in a way, because I have so much control over all these elements in the studio myself, that nothing gets lost in translation. And this can happen in dealing with, let's say, instrumental music, where you have so many stages of the process to go through before the sonic result. So you're thinking of what it sounds like, then you're thinking of how to translate that in musical notation, and then that's then interpreted by performers, and then the audience receives it. So there's so many stages, but when you are able to create all the sound yourself, I think there's less chance of it being lost. The original idea, the original kind of sonic memory of it doesn't get lost along the way.
In some sense, I might say to you, it's actually your performance as much as it is a composition.
That's exactly right. And you know that what you're sharing with the world is absolutely what you first imagined, which is very important for me.
Is it fun using the machines and so forth?
It's exciting because it's changing all the time and you're learning new things all the time. And I feel it is definitely a tool to create this music. And I don't get so excited about every new program that comes out or new gear and things like that. I just want it to be there to allow me to get into that headspace.
If computerized music making can be seen as a sort of a cold, sort of additive computational exercise, you're adding voice to it then. Is it able to add that strangeness to the voice to good effect sometimes?
I think so. And I think using the voice in that way and affecting it and processing and manipulating it adds a whole other dimension closer to what you might imagine in a kind of a dreamlike way of what your voice might sound like, rather than how it actually is.
So the electronic manipulation helps you to sort of transcend the normal reality of the voice.
That's it.
I'm interested too that you have decided to draw on some texts. I might instance Raymond Carver. Is that a different process again, or are the words actually guiding you in some way in your process?
In those instances, it has to have a very strong personal resonance with me in order for me to enter into it. That was really important for me with the Carver poems because I had loved that work.
Late Fragment. Which you title Beloved on the Earth. And of course he writes that towards the end of his life, as far as I understand. Would you mind reading it for me?
Late Fragment by Raymond Carver. And did you get what you wanted from this life even so? I did. And what did you want? To call myself beloved. To feel myself beloved on the earth.
It's actually heartbreaking stuff.
There's a simplicity to it that lends us this kind of poignancy. And because there's no barrier of convolution, it's just very minimal. And I think the poems are even more direct.
They are.
They're obviously the most personal thing he's done.
Incredible.
I first encountered his work when I was still a teenager, and it just stayed with me for so many years. And I always imagined setting this text, so I chose three poems of his. And I was amazed that we had the opportunity to work with these texts. And so setting that for choir and orchestra was a huge joy for me. And it was one of kind of the most emotional experiences I've ever had working on a piece was with that, I think. And that feeling when you enter into the room and you hear a choir, an orchestra, 200 people on a stage singing something that you wrote in your room, you know, it's just an incredible feeling.
Thank you. Well, we worked together, Linda, on, I suppose one could call it a song cycle in the Irish language, drawn from both poetic and Shannos sources, which was a tremendous pleasure for me. In fact, one of my oddest memories in a way was when you sent me the first mock-up was, oh my God, she shouldn't be asking me to sing this. She should be singing this. You had a way of doing it that was very complete. How did this whole project start, which was called Ichter Mara?
I had always wanted to work with you, and we had talked about it, and I was very interested in these texts, and these texts are really interesting in that they are from like the 7th century right up until recent times. And very emotional aspects of love and loss in a way that really spoke to me. And I chose 4 poems from this that I felt most connected to. And I suppose the one that struck me in such a poignant way the most was by Kathleen Maud.
Kathleen Maud, the poet and the Shannos singer from Connemara. Really a very specifically beautiful singing voice, but then also remarkably frank and powerful love poems. Tell me something about this particular poem.
Well, this poem is all about saying goodbye to your loved one and telling them to go off into the world and to leave you behind, almost. So there's a certain strength in that, I think, but there's an immense sadness in that too, of the letting go of it. And that ends the whole song cycle, and that's where the title comes from, speaking to you from ocean's floor, almost that sense that you're a ghost and you're coming back to speak to the person who's been left behind. And there's a little section of it here, and that kind of illustrates this. I once walked on the beach. I walked to the water's edge. Wave frolicked with wave. The white foam tongued my feet. I slowly raised my eye, and there far out on the deep, where foam and wave tangle, I saw the loneliness in your eye and the anguish in your face. So there's something about that it's just absolutely heartbreaking. And the combination of your voice with string quartet and electronics just really gave harmonic voice to this sense of anguish, I think.
Of course, Kathleen Maud's own life was tragically cut short also, but she remains sort of a powerful sort of woman voice in the poetic tradition and in the singing tradition too. She's quite an interesting character because she has mastery of both, I think. You know, most singers in the tradition, they invariably they receive a repertoire. And I think it was very beautiful to be able to make her poem into a song. I wonder sometimes had she imagined herself that it could be a song. And I also remember the one that we had, the Ogonigan and Chul Chrevig, another beautiful traditional song. I might actually read a little bit of the Irish. Ireg, le Kathleen Maud. Shul agra, kush tra anucht. Shul agus kurwit nadora. Eirig agus shul anucht. Na factach luin fasta, ig uig shin antleve. Tána bláha sin fiúte, agus táma chanávasa dróite. Láurím leat a nucht ó íochtar mara, láurím leat gach íhe, ó íochtar mara. Hiúlas lá cos trá, hiúlas go híochtar trá. Rinne tón súgra le tón, ligan cúr bán ma chosa. Dar dís ma húl gamául, gus an siú da mu ar an daun, in ai réig cúir agus tinne, chunic an tuaganas i da húl. Gus an da lias i da gnúis. Hiúlas amach ar an daun, ó glúin go caum, agus ó chaum go gwile, nugur slogog me, sa da lias gus san uaganas. Kathleen Maud. And you've been up to Iceland. What did you find there? I mean, was it different from what you expected? And you've written in these places. You haven't just gone to visit. You've gone there to actually create and to feed off whatever it has to offer.
When I first landed in Iceland, I was slightly nervous because it was that feeling of never meet your heroes. I had imagined this place for so long, and it had been sort of a part of me for many years, having written songs in Icelandic text, but not having actually physically been there. But when I touched down in the country, I really felt it far surpassed any of my expectations. Just the sense of the landscape changing all the time. When you go around the corner along the ring road, you really get a feeling of just massive awe and wonder of power of the landscape and the beauty of it. And the most huge waterfalls that I've ever seen in my life, I saw the Aurora Borealis, and all those things seeped into me. Where I was staying was east of Reykjavik, and it was overlooking Mount Hekla, which is a really interesting place. It has a very interesting history and story connected to it, which is all to do with legends of witches. That kind of, they say that Mount Hekla is where the witches enter on their way to hell and all this. And I would see that every morning when I woke up. And the first time I was there, it was August, and there were 23 hours of daylight. So just this kind of pink hue in the sky that I've never really seen. My music started to change. I could feel it. After a few weeks of being there, it was like as if everything just became panoramic, and the sound just spread out and opened out. And it was like seeing such vivid colours and feeling that in the music as well.
Before you wrote these pieces, you must have been listening to some music from up there. What was influencing you? What was in your head?
Well, from many years ago, it would have been Björk. And I just felt that there was something very interesting coming out of the country, and it connected very strongly with my own aesthetic in a way. And also I think that interest in the melancholic and not being afraid to go into those dark places. And it's very interesting when you meet Icelandic people, many of them kind of work away very quietly themselves and producing a lot of great work and art. And then they have that side of them which is very much kind of hedonistic and partying and going out in Reykjavik till 4 a.m. So it's that kind of interesting, the manic versus the melancholic, which I think we have in a lot of us as Irish people as well.
Now, writing in a language that is not your own, what's the appeal? Is there something that impels you to do it? Is there something drawing you to do it? Is it just curiosity?
I think it is curiosity, but I think for many years I felt I wasn't ready to set texts in English, that it felt too overtly descriptive or something, that I wanted to have something that was outside of that and that would bring you into the music and not be overly narrative, or I was sort of worried about this aspect, I think.
Is that because of, say, the notion that the English language belongs to pop? And the minute you say anything in English, it's being interpreted straight away in terms of it might belong to that school or that world or that world. Did you want to be free of that?
I think so. And I think because at that time I felt like it was pulling you out of the music too much. And I suppose as well, you know, looking back over the years, a lot of the music that I loved, it wasn't necessarily in very clear English form. Like, you know, the most interesting example of that for me growing up was the Cocteau Twins. And even people like Sigur Rós and him singing in Hopelandic, as he calls it, which is not even Icelandic. It's sort of this made up language.
How extraordinary do you think that was as an achievement for them? Just even doing that. I mean, this is a hugely successful alternative pop band, global, and they're singing a language that doesn't really mean anything.
I think for them, it is all about the atmosphere and it's not about being descriptive. And that has always been important to me as well. And some of the first texts I set were in Icelandic and in Latin. And it wasn't until years later that I started to want to set more texts in English. And then I turned to things like Rumi poetry.
So you are drawn to the notion that there's meaning beyond the technical, literal meaning.
I think so. And I think I think there's almost sometimes a little bit of disappointment in learning what the origins of some musical texts are, because it takes you away from that transcendent experience. Like even when you think of the English translation of Mozart's Marriage of Figaro or The Magic Flute or something, oftentimes there's a scene that's about something that's really banal and someone is chasing someone around a garden. But in song in Italian, it sounds absolutely profound. But then you would learn that it's not necessarily that.
So semantic ignorance is bliss.
It can be, maybe, sometimes.
I mean, you're just back from New York. You were on a Fulbright to New York, NYU. You stayed there for a year. Typically, what do you do in those situations?
Well, it seems as if I'm drawn to opposites in a way, that I'm drawn to these very isolated places, often on islands, or the middle of Manhattan, which is, you can't get more different than that, really. So In New York, I was very inspired by a lot of electronic improvisation that was happening. And in the cross-genre world there, where there's very little boundaries between different styles of music. And they're presented in a way that is really broadening the spectrum of audience and listeners. And I think that's important in that, you know, that new music isn't seen as something that is very lofty or unreachable. I think it needs to be part of us and part of the natural everyday world, and that it doesn't seem removed from everyday people, let's say.
And many listeners might be interested to know, how is it that a piece of composition comes into existence? I mean, you know, just the other day I saw you do a marvelous piece with David Power called Antarctica. Where you had these huge images on a sort of a very eroded wall surface of Shackleton's voyage to the Antarctic and his isolation and the crushing of the ship, etc. And then in the middle of all this, you're singing also. As well as manipulating electronic sounds, manipulating the sounds of David's instruments, which are whistle, pipe, and fiddle. Is that an example of a piece of work that could illustrate for us how your work comes into being?
Absolutely. And I think something like Antarctica, it's really interesting in that it brings up the whole issue of whether or not one responds to visual, or whether or not visual aspect responds to the sonic. And in this case, the visual aspect responded to the sonic, which is quite unusual for me in terms of process.
You mean you get the visual first and you might be asked to respond to it. But in this case, you created the sonic and the visual was choreographed to meet that.
Exactly. So in a way, it was like I had to conjure up these images for myself of what the music meant and what kind of a journey it would take us on. And it is not necessarily a literal representation of Shackleton and his incredible journey, but it's more abstract and it's more about the emotion and the atmosphere and the awe and wonder of seeing that landscape, and also the terror and the danger as part of that as well. Also the sense of sonic landscape, so the sounds of Weddell seals from the Weddell Sea, underwater sound, and I'm very interested in those sounds from the natural environment as well.
I also think that many of your works are, to the ear at least, situated kind of north of the Arctic Circle. And why is that?
It was really interesting. I was reading about this recently. Glenn Gould talks a lot about that sense of the north and the otherness and the otherworldly quality of that. And I have experienced that myself in places like Iceland and Gotland in the Baltic Sea, where I immediately always feel sort of at home in these places. And I'm not sure exactly why. It almost feels like part of me is from those places or something. I just feel very at home there. And I'm always drawn to cold countries and music that's made in cold countries.
Looking at it from the outside, as I am definitely an outsider in that world, Could it be said that you're part of the sort of new generation of new classical in Dublin that came out of Trinity?
I think it was a very particular time in Irish musical history when I moved to Dublin, actually, and this was in 2000. And at that point, Crash Ensemble had just started. There was a feeling of excitement, of adventure, of spontaneity. It felt like there was a spirit of something new was emerging and that you didn't have to be stuffy about it. It was vital and it was relevant and it was young, and I really connected to that ethos at the time and have since worked a lot with Crash.
Was it welcomed with open arms, or was there some resistance?
I think formality is something that I've always struggled with in the classical world. And, you know, the thought of having to go and sit quietly and wear suits and all this kind of thing really has always felt uncomfortable for me. And I definitely veer away from that. And I feel in the kind of work that I'm doing now and the way that it's presented, hopefully those barriers are being broken down. That's important to me. Because when I was growing up, that world would have seemed so alien to me. And I entered into it in a kind of more unusual route, I think. But I absolutely was not born with a silver spoon and taught that classical music is, in
the
a
pinnacle.
Way... Exactly. Hmm.
Because you yourself have written for forces as large as a symphonic orchestra and for the BBC, etc. How was that as an experience for you?
Well, I mean, that is something that is immensely rewarding when you enter into a rehearsal space, let's say, with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and just the huge expansive sound that can be created by that many performers. And they were very receptive to what I was doing, and I felt like it absolutely was not lost in translation. And I was incredibly moved by their performance.
Of your piece Chio, is it?
That's it. That piece is inspired by haiku poetry by the Japanese poet Chiyo Ni, who was one of the most famous female haiku poets. And her work is very much about creating a very clear, simple image. You know, one of them being moonflowers, the beauty of hidden things, cool, clear water, that is all there is. You know, these tiny moments in life that are just captured very simply and beautifully. And that really inspired the whole piece, that you could have a snapshot of the string family for a moment and just the clean beauty of that. And a little snapshot of winds in a very kind of unadorned form. And then kind of building up the whole orchestra.
Many composers of your generation, they write for a variety of forces, but they also compose that music would be performed and experienced in many different sorts of places, in different spatial environments. How much of that do you do, and what sort of process is involved in creating for a place and people in that place?
Well, there's lots of different approaches to that, and I'm a member of this group called the Spatial Music Collective, which are very much interested in spatially separating live musicians or choirs with loudspeaker placement. So this is a really beautiful idea that emerged in the 16th century, that sense of spatially separating singers and musicians to create these very interesting effects. So they're the earliest kind of echo and delay effects we have, really, that are actually composed into the music. And we kind of think about spatial music as being this very recent phenomenon. It's not at all. That music is hugely inspiring for me, where you have these interweaving lines and harmonies, and you're not quite sure where it's going to take you next.
Could you cite a specific piece of your own that can take advantage of these things?
The probably best example of that would be Fall Approaches.
I think that we in the folk world have a lot to learn from you guys, because I actually think that the folk musicians are less open than you guys.
Well, I think part of our world in what we do all the time is being like almost musical magpies and taking information and influence and ideas from so many different sources, perhaps more so than is associated with some more traditional musicians, let's say.
Does it ever worry you on that? Sometimes people pick out a thing and they think that's it, because it's the thing that tickles their ear at the time. It doesn't really perceive any further depth in the musical message of that particular type of music. Like, does that ever come up, for example, in the arena that you work in as an educator?
It can, and it's something that I thought a lot about in the year that I was in New York, and I felt that my own sense of Irishness emerged for me more so than when I'm in Ireland. And maybe it's that you tap into that deeper sense of who you are and where you come from and how important that is to you. I feel like it has strengthened that, it has augmented it, it is emerging more in the music now. But I think a path has kind of naturally found its way to me, and that is very much about something that is collaborative, working with musicians from many other disciplines, and it probably is moving further away from something that is formal and something that is classical in a way.
You've referenced in this conversation that young composers ask you questions, because of course you also work as a lecturer. Is it important to you to have interaction with younger composers?
I think there's something vocational about it. I think there's something where you want to share your experience with others. And there's something incredibly rewarding about seeing young composers have a germ of an idea and bringing that to the fully fledged performance. And it's like you take that journey with them. And sometimes you have moments of where they're unsure and they look to you for reassurance. And part of it is definitely about that. And it's not just about the technical training. It's about that mentoring and the nurturing. And because that's been important to me in my own life. And I want to give that back into the world.
Linda, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for giving us your time and your wisdom and your insights.
Thank you very much.
we'll keep it formal now.
And me saying that
we're only informal, we're on the high stool. I have a very formal relationship with her otherwise.